be alone each and every night. While you're away, don't forget to write. Bye-bye, so long, farewell. Bye-bye, so long. See you in September.
The lament of the White House press corps as President Trump on Friday left to go to Bedminster for, 17 days, I think, Jim Galloway?
Yeah, I always wanted to go to New Jersey for my vacations. I mean, I've dreamt of that.
We should point out, and the White House has been very sensitive about this, that two things. Number one, past presidents, including President Obama, President Clinton, Democratic presidents, have taken extended vacations. And in this day of communication and technology, it really doesn't matter a great deal whether you're
They're always working vacations, aren't they?
Yeah, they're always working vacations.
Yeah, right.
Nevertheless, he's off, and it seemed to me See You in September was exactly the right song to play for the president. Jim Galloway is here, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the newspaper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog, which has gone through a change. You got to have a subscription now to get all the goodies.
We are going behind the paywall.
Yeah, well, it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it. Brian Robinson, Republican strategist, a former staff member, communications director for Governor Nathan Deal. Good to have you back. It's Monday. You're here.
Happy Monday, Bill.
And so is your good friend, Theron Johnson, Democratic strategist, has run campaigns at all levels, including being in charge of President Obama's reelection campaign in the Southeast. Theron, it's always good. I know ever since you started your new company especially, you are on the move. So we're glad you could be here today.
I wouldn't be any place else.
Okay.
Except for New Jersey.
Yeah.
If only that invitation had been extended.
You know, I wanted to point something out that was just brought to my attention as the show was getting set to go on the air that makes me feel pretty proud. The University of Missouri Reynolds Journalism Institute just completed a study of the most and least trusted news sources in the United States.
I've got my fingers crossed.
I am pleased to say that NPR comes in as fifth most trusted, I guess. I've got to see that more closely, behind The Economist, public television in general, Reuters, and the BBC, and NPR is next, and right behind them is PBS. So I hope all of you out there who listen to this show regularly agree that we try to be as trustworthy as possible. all right, let's talk. Jim, the New York Times on Sunday published a story that is in many ways a speculative piece. They talked to 75 Republican insiders to get this story done. And the gist of the story, the headline is Republican Shadow Campaign for 2020 Takes Shape as Trump Doubts Grow.
Of course. I mean, this was an inevitable story. I mean, you've had John Kasich out there for months campaigning on Medicare expansion, or at least protecting some elements of Obamacare. Now you have Jeff Flake out there with a new book. Books are always great to run a presidential campaign on, in which he says, "Gosh, maybe we shouldn't have embraced that birtherism way back when. Maybe that was a mistake." No, this is it is a question. I'm getting daily emails. I don't pass them on because I think it's silly, but I'm getting emails from Las Vegas with the odds of Trump finishing out his campaign.
Yeah. What are the odds right now?
I mean, finishing out his term. I don't even open them anymore.
Well, you know what? Send them to me because I think that's a good bet right now.
You know, it is interesting. Let me just give you a couple of lines from the article. You've got a White House spokesperson. Well, first of all, the White House is really pushing back on this entire story, particularly as it talks about Vice President Mike Pence. And the Times reporting on this makes it clear that Pence really has been out a lot. He's been in early primary states like Iowa. He's been meeting with big donors, insiders at the Naval Observatory, the vice president's residence. And the Times describes him as creating an independent power base, cementing his status as Mr. Trump's heir apparent, and promoting himself as the main conduit between the Republican donor class and the administration. Brian, he's pushing back very hard on that report.
He's pushing back very hard on the implication that he's aiming for 2020. All of the stuff that you just mentioned sounds like things that are perfectly fine and good, commendable even, for a vice president to do. No one has been more loyal and true to Donald Trump. Every one of these behind-the-scenes stories that you read says, even in private, at dinner with close friends, he never breaks character, so to speak. He never disparages the president in any way, always talks about him as someone committed to making America great again. It would be hard to find a more loyal foxhole buddy than Mike Pence has been to Donald Trump. Now, any vice president who will do those political events, those diplomatic events, those meetings with legislators that you mentioned, any would if they were doing their jobs. But any vice president is also looking at the next step up the ladder. Every single one. Joe Biden, the former, is still looking at maybe running in 2020, even though he's going to be 113, I believe, in 2020. And Pence is, if anything, preparing for 2024, and only preparing for 2020 if Trump decided not to run for re-election. There's no problem with that.
It's a break glass presidential campaign.
Yeah, but let me jump in here. Okay, so let's just go back. A lot of Republicans, when this race started for president, probably including Brian, I don't want to accuse him of things, but they did not think, number one, that Trump would win the primary. Number two, they questioned whether Trump was actually conservative enough. And it's always been this chatter about Mike Pence being the most conservative, most liked person within the Republican Party. So let's not act like no one has ever, ever thought that Mike Pence could succeed Donald Trump, one, if he got impeached. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that he's done anything that has been proven to be impeachable at this time, but boy, we're very close. But every Republican I talk to says that, hey, you know what, if Donald Trump goes down, if he does something, or if he just decided he didn't want to be president anymore, we can all live with Mike Pence. So yes, Mike Pence is clearly there as a placeholder, as a second option, just in case this unhinged president does something where he's removed from office.
So let's point out, you've got the Times talks about several people, of course. Jim has already said John Kasich. And Kasich's been fairly outspoken in saying, you know, he may very well come back and try to make a race at some point down the line. Could be 2020. Ben Sasse is mentioned with some regularity in this. A couple of people have suggested, she's not in the New York Times piece, but as this article started getting traction, there were a couple of Republicans who said, well, don't count Nikki Haley out. She's been a much better UN ambassador than people ever gave her credit, thought that she would be when she went into the job.
Right. Let me pick up on something that Theron said. We've talked about impeachment and will he finish out? Will he be allowed to finish out his term? But I think it's equally as possible that Trump is kind of a James Polk, a one-term kind of guy, and in that you don't see him having a whole lot of fun with his presidency. He finds it aggravating. He finds it he finds his life circumscribed by the Secret Service and all the formalities. It is entirely possible that, say, come January in 2020, he says, or 2019, I'm done.
Well, here's one of the things that's interesting about this, Brian, is that the New York Times, one of the little pieces of evidence that the New York Times cites as a possible evidence that maybe he's thinking about this, is he put on as chief of staff a guy who the Times calls sharp-elbowed, talking about our friend Nick Ayers from Georgia.
Yeah, and Nick had a very fierce response, a sharp-elbowed response.
Sharp-elbowed, yeah, I'm sorry.
on Twitter this weekend, and called it fake news, attacked the New York Times, and said that, please note, no donor stepped forward and said that I said this to them. So, you know, really strong words from him there. Nick is also, before he was the chief of staff for Pence, was running his political operation, running his super PAC. So Nick is very involved in any long-term plan that Mike Pence has. So it doesn't surprise me, it does not scandalize me, that Nick may in some capacity be talking about the future in politics for Mike Pence. It seems like what Nick's supposed to be doing. And let me tell you what, if I'm Mike Pence, Nick Ayers is exactly the guy that I want having those conversations for me. He's one of the best in the business.
But let's be fair to our listeners. I keep going back here, and I'm in a great mood today. I just got off vacation for 10 days, and so I'm not irritable at all, unlike Trump. Listen, never in 8 years ago, Jim, would we be talking about Vice President Biden running to succeed President Obama.
Oh, no.
I'm just trying to really frame this for our audience. We're talking, this guy has been in office less than 7 months, and there is not one, not two, not three, not four, possibly five candidates who legitimately are out here working to run against him. I'm not going to go as far as to say that there's this disarray and all this turmoil in the Republican Party. But Brian, we've got to be clear, dude. This never happened 8 years ago. Everyone knew that Barack Obama was going to be the Democratic nominee in 2012. Because
I don't recall this happening leading up to the second term of W.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there was never a conversation about Dick Cheney,
right,
who was put there to keep W in place, to make sure that he could read things properly and make sure that he understood government.
Well, he was put there because he chose himself as the head of selection.
That's right. And look,
be vice president.
And Cheney is an anomaly historically of a VP who did not have aspirations to be president and did not run. You know, Dan Quayle ran, even George H.W. Bush.
But Al Gore, you never saw Al Gore. Not until the Clinton had his second term did Al Gore start running for president.
But this is super important. I want to respond directly to what Theron said and what you're saying, Jim. Mike Pence has not said he's running for president in 2020. If anything, they are head faking towards 2024, just like Biden, just like Gore, et cetera.
Here is specifically a part of the most vociferous part of the Pence written reaction. Quote, today's article in the New York Times is disgraceful and offensive to me, my family, and our entire team. He went on to say that he was working solely for Trump's agenda and that anyone who says he's not is being laughable and absurd. That's a heavy, heavy response.
And it's not directed at you. It's directed at that guy who's playing golf in New Jersey.
Exactly. Yeah.
But Kellyanne Conway says something very interesting.
Want to listen to it and then we'll talk about it?
Yeah, but I want to go back to something that Kellyanne Conway said. But let's listen to it. I mean,
well, I'm not sure we'll have the same thing. But
what I was going to say is when Spicer, you know, Brian's best friend Spicer resigned, and the mooch who now is gone. I know you guys talked about that last week. Remember she said
it broke during the show last week.
Yeah. You remember she said the best advice she gave Scaramucci was do not treat the president as a peer. She actually said that one of the mistakes that a lot of people in the White House right now are, number one, not being loyal to this president, and they're treating him as a peer. I think you see this forceful response from Nick Ayers, who's this Georgian that everyone loves, and the vice president himself, because they're all terrified that if you show any little centimeter of disloyalty to this president, he will chop your head off. He will ask for your resignation. He will fire you. I think that's why you see these folks coming back strongly, not because they don't want to run one.
I'm glad I didn't play that before you talked, because I was thinking of something that Kellyanne Conway said yesterday on This Week to George Stephanopoulos. Let's listen.
The president says privately and publicly often, George, that he'll be there for 7.5 more years. So he plans on being a two-term president. I read that article and I want to say a few things about it. It is absolutely true that the vice president is getting ready for 2020 for re-election as vice president.
So no concern he's setting up a shadow campaign.
He's also getting ready for 2018. Zero concern. That is complete fiction. That is complete fabrication. And I know that his advisors who had comments attributed to them have pushed back very strongly, as has the vice president, and as am I right now, unequivocally.
All right. I would love to close out this portion of the conversation with what I think may be kind of a 10,000 or 40,000 foot view of all of this speculation reported by the Times yesterday. And that's this. I said on this show the day after the health care bill finally met its final fate in the United States Senate, that I wondered if that was the beginning, just the beginnings, of a possible effort by a number of Republicans to take Trump on in the primaries in the leading up to the 2020 election. Now, we don't know how this is all going to play out, but it does seem to me, Jim, that this is of the same piece of Republicans in the Senate who are saying, sorry, Mr. President, you want to do health care? We don't. We're going to keep people. We're going to keep the Senate in some semblance of order to keep doing some business so the president can't make a recess appointment, can't fire the attorney general, bring someone else new in. I do wonder if we are sensing that with all the problems the Trump presidency is having, the beginnings of some feeling that perhaps there needs to be an alternative to Trump in the 2020 race.
Exactly. In fact, in the arguments you've heard Ohio Governor John Kasich make, in the more recent arguments you've heard Jeff Flake, especially on Meet the Press yesterday, make, it seems to me that both of them are arguing that there is a moral obligation to provide Trump with opposition in next year, in the 2020 GOP primary.
McCain is quoted in the Times piece as saying, quote, they see weakness in this president. Look, it's not a nice business we're in. And Bill Kristol, a longtime a Republican, conservative thinker, he was Vice President Quayle's chief of staff, says we need to take – he's never been a fan of Trump, so it's probably not as surprising. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, he says we need to take one shot at liberating the Republican Party from Trump and conservatism from Trump. So, I mean, this is all part of I think we're going to see a lot of this questioning of where the party is headed with Trump. So it's interesting. Let's do this. Let's get a break in. And when we come back – we're going to turn to some other business, including, among other things, a Procter & Gamble, a P&G TV spot that's getting a lot of attention, both positive and negative, and I can't wait to hear the panel's response to it. This is Political Rewind.
Christopher Kimball is bringing his new show, Milk Street Live, to the First Center in Atlanta, September 20th. He'll reveal cooking secrets from around the world, offer taste tests, and invite audience members to join in an onstage cooking contest. Support GPB now, and you'll receive 2 orchestra-level tickets to the show. Attend an exclusive pre-show meet and greet with Christopher Kimball, and receive his newest book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Go to gpb.org/milkstreet. That's gpb.org/milkstreet. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Theron Johnson, Brian Robinson, Jim Galloway in the studio today. Jim, over the weekend, the Republican State Party, the Executive Committee met. There were a couple of very interesting items from the public's point of view on the agenda. One was that there was an effort being made to put in place a requirement that candidates for governor were going to have to sign a pledge that they would work to pass the religious liberty bill that has stalled and failed about 4 years in a row at the General Assembly.
Right, right. This is the one that vetoed by Nathan Deal 2 years ago, and would offer some sort of protection to religious conservatives who don't want to work with same-sex couples in their businesses. And you have this, you have the forces, of course, are Georgia business interests who are vastly opposed to it, and the social conservatives who are pushing for it. And you've got the governor's race right there in the center, caught between the two. Casey Cagle more so than anybody else.
Because he had previously supported this a couple sessions ago when he was courting evangelicals.
It made some noises as if he were supporting
it. That's right.
But he never had a vote.
Okay.
And of course, Brian Kemp, Hunter Hill, and running for Secretary of State, Josh McCoon, of course. They're all deeply, deeply in favor of it.
Okay, but the Executive Committee decided they would not, in fact, require a pledge on this issue, which doesn't mean they're not going to see it as something that it will be discussed in the campaign. What is the point? What does it mean that they rejected?
This was kind of set up. I don't know that it was intended as such, but it was evolving into a trap for Casey Cagle, where he would have to run against his own party if they pass this resolution, or disavow his connections with the business community. And this way, he gets a little wiggle room to skirt by on the issue. And we get to carry the argument to the campaign trail, if you will.
Theron, where do you think this whole issue is going to play into the race next year? And do you think it's a potent and powerful one for Republicans to run on?
Well, I think that's the reason why this group kind of waved it off. Because, one, it's going to cause an amount of dissension within the Republican primary. But, you know, let's not make it into a partisan issue, Bill. I mean, we're talking about people who are unjustly being prosecuted, right? If you want to protect someone's freedom. And I think with the Republican Party, which was kind of sad for me, is that, you know, on one hand, and Brian talked a lot about this, Donald Trump and his convention and a little bit during the campaign talked about strengthening the community with the GOP and the LGBTQ community. I think a part of that conversation needs to be, if you really want to protect people who are unjustly being prosecuted in this state, are LGBTQ Georgians. But the truth of the matter is this. Republicans know that if religious freedom or religious liberties is at the cornerstone of the argument between a Democrat and Republican in a general election next year, at a time when we just talked about a president who's unhinged, who's already causing tremendous amount of dissension within the National Party, the one thing I have to commend the Republicans for, at least they came together and said, you know what, guys, let's stop this. Let's not fall into this trap. Because if the conversation is about religious freedoms and religious liberties, and it's not about jobs and education and healthcare in Georgia in 2018, I think that gives Democrats a good opportunity to show Georgians that these people are continuing to talk about an issue that right now, I mean, because there are some folks that say, you know what, I mean, people, this is a country that was founded on religious freedom, and are really Christians feeling like their liberties and all their freedom is taken away from them, right? And so I think that ultimately, I agree with Jim that this was a way to sort of create an opportunity for Casey Cagle to not be sort of bought into this. But it's very hard for Kemp, Hill, and others who are adamantly in support of this to make sure that this issue comes up and how it plays in the primary.
Brian, I may have my timing off here, but during your tenure as the communications and deputy chief of staff for the governor, the Religious Liberty Bill must have had one of its earlier iterations, yes?
The last year that I was there, I believe it did. It died in the legislature.
But it was introduced. I mean,
it was introduced. Yes.
I guess the question where does this? I mean, I understand that there's a certain group of particularly conservative Republicans, the Josh McCoon Republicans out there, who are determined to continue to push this, but where does this gain real momentum? Where does it gain the weight that allows it to keep coming back? Help us understand that.
Well, it's a wedge issue that fires up the base, which is the issues that you're always looking for. And I want to commend the new GOP chairman, John Watson, for coming to a compromise that appeases all sides. They passed a resolution that supports religious freedom, but did away with the pledge. The fact is, the state party, neither ours nor the Democrats, need to be in the pledge business. That's utterly ridiculous. You handcuff your candidates. The purpose of parties isn't about policy so much. It is about politics, about getting people elected. And the best way for Republicans to get elected is to give them the freedom to hit the issues that are most important to voters. So kudos to John Watson for effectively driving that message. Let me also say another issue that Watson faced is the party that he inherited has hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. The people who are going to pay that debt are not the activists who are hellbound on getting this issue enacted into law.
Oh, no, they're the big businesses.
It's the big businesses who are resolutely opposed to it. So the party can make a choice, and I think Saturday it did. It made a good choice that it can be about extreme issues that have a narrow base that people are really energized about. Or it can have a broad-based party that can raise money and function and win elections. I want it to be the latter. And that's not to say that religious liberty isn't important. Even Theron here was saying it's important. It's constitutional. It's foundational. Here's the thing. I believe wholeheartedly in religious freedom. But we are protected by the Constitution, and there is not one example of someone's rights in Georgia being prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law by the state or local government. It's never happened.
If he hadn't already left, you would have thought he wrote the speech that Nathan Deal gave when he vetoed that last time it came out.
I think he's done some ghostwriting.
but Nathan Deal would kill me, so I must say that Nathan Deal wrote that veto speech.
But this is the thing, and Brian just hit on something that's very interesting right now within the Republican Party in Georgia, is that you do have a party that financially is not in a place where they can actually go out and try to reelect and elect Republicans. However, what they did on Saturday, let's just really listen to what really happened. You have a group of people, and I'm not saying this doesn't happen in the Democratic Party, too. There's a lot of things that happen in our conventions that I think should not necessarily be discussed. But in order to placate to a business community who has come out and said that we do not want this to happen because we don't want to end up like Mike Pence in Indiana when that happened. And Lord knows we don't want to end up like North Carolina. So how do you then go back to this community as a GOP party when you're allowing the people who make up the voting base of the party, people who want this religious liberty, to be at the forefront of the argument? And my thing is, I just think that we are a country that was founded on religious freedom. And I think the Republicans, honestly, if this is truly about freedom and people who are unjustly being prosecuted in this state, then I guarantee you the majority of those people in that room at that convention has never experienced some of the things that people of color experience in other religions and stuff like that.
Go ahead real quick. Let's finish
all
it up.
All I was going to say is that Mr. Trump has done the GOP in some respects a favor by mixing up what it means to be a conservative. And right now, those arguments are going to be carried out in a 2018 primary.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any question.
Two quick things there. The Supreme Court is going to hear a case this fall that will have serious implications for this issue. Maybe it will be resolved. We now have a conservative majority back on the court. So this issue may come to a resolution without us passing a law that could hurt our economy in Georgia.
Two,
conservatives are much less scared today that Trump is in office than they were when Obama was in office about religious freedom.
Thank you, Brian. One other quick note, Jim. The GOP State Committee also this weekend decided that they were going to take a firm stand against the casino gambling in Georgia. And, of course, what's interesting about that is the new chair, John Watson, had to recuse himself from that conversation since he represents casino interests at the Capitol.
Right. And he had a lot of, shall we say, friends, I'll put those in quotes, at the state capitol watching him, wondering what position he was going to take.
But let me comment on that because I represented MGM, I'll be fully disclosed, but Watson is willing to take a walk and recuse himself when it comes to an issue that he's lobbying on, how he makes his money. I'm never against anybody making money. But then you strike a deal when you have an opportunity to, you know, preserve the business community, which is going to help you raise money. I just think that, to your point, Bill, I want to make this point. Donald Trump has put every single Republican Party around the country in a very tough bind. But I got to give Watson credit. He's doing the best he can to try to facilitate a very unhinged.
All right. We are marking this date, August 7th, 2017, as the date that Theron Johnson said something nice about John Watson. And we'll see. We're going to start the clock.
Oh, Watson and I are cool. Okay. I mean, I'm cool with Republicans. Obviously, Brian is my friend who claims me on Twitter.
All right. Don't take it too seriously.
But I also want to hold him accountable for not saying he can't have it both ways.
All right. Jim, I want to take on another issue that your paper this weekend did a big takeout on. We've talked, obviously, a lot about health care and the efforts in Washington and the Senate and the House to repeal and replace. And that's all well and good. But there's an interesting aspect of Obamacare that I think is worth our discussing, because I think Tamar Hallerman had the bylines on. There is an aspect of Obamacare that is going to be phased out called the Disproportionate Share Hospital Program.
The nomenclature is their DSH payments.
These are payments to hospitals like Grady and other hospitals in the state here.
And Savannah Memorial.
That have to take care of a lot of indigent patients, people who have no doctors, so they come to the emergency room for their primary care. And so Obamacare paid subsidies for those patients to those hospitals, and it's going to be phased out.
Right. The idea when the Affordable Care Act was installed was that all the states would expand their Medicaid rolls, and as a result, these DSH payments, these indigent payments that the federal government had been making for years and years and years, could be phased out. It was kind of a cost savings. Well, 19 states didn't expand,
including
Georgia, didn't expand Medicare. And still, those payments are going to be, there's an October deadline. And the problem is that this isn't something that can be avoided by simply not voting. There has to be a positive vote to continue on both part of the House and the Senate, or tens of millions of dollars are going to disappear from Georgia hospitals.
And we should point out, Brian, because this is something we hadn't thought about, you know, for all those people who were cheering for Obamacare to remain in place, this was, it was Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue who were able to put language into the Senate version of the bill that would have guaranteed the continuation of these DSH payments. And without that bill having passed, despite the cheering, especially from Democrats, it creates this potential crisis up ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of those parts of Obamacare that must be fixed no matter what we do on repeal. Even if it's not repealed, this needs to be fixed. And I think it can be done separately. They can pass the appropriations needed to fund these hospitals. Now, what we have now is a two-tiered system. This is something Jim and I talked about two years ago. We have Obamacare economies and non-Obamacare economies. That is, the states that expanded Medicaid and those that didn't. Those that did are getting billions and billions and billions more every year than states that didn't. Now, the states that didn't have a fiscal argument to make that it's going to that they can't trust the federal government to pay their fair share for a long time in the future. It will eat into already really tight state budgets that are already facing pressures from Medicaid's growing population. So there's legitimate arguments on both sides. There's no bad actors here, but those that did not expand need to have some equitable remedy from the federal government.
The problem here is if we keep going down the road where we have an Obamacare healthcare system in some states and a non-Obamacare healthcare system in other states, is that economic development is going to take note of that. You're not going to get, companies are going to be far more likely to settle in states where their health, where healthcare is more available to their workers. And so you're going to start to see some, at least you've got a lot of economists who are afraid you're going to start to see some difference in the economies in these two types, in red and blue states.
Yeah, we're going to have to watch how this develops. I want to move on. We got a couple other items that I really think are important for us to get to today. One of them is the commercial that I mentioned at the start of the show and then just a little while ago. P&G, Procter & Gamble, put out a commercial some time ago about the image of women, young women particularly, that people found poignant and moving because it addressed lots of issues that women are concerned about today. But they just released another spot that deals with mothers talking, African-American mothers talking to their children about issues of race that they're going to face. You cannot obviously see the commercial, but you're going to see, for instance, a mother talking to her daughter. They're sitting in her car, and she's giving her a driving lesson. You're going to see a mother with her Little League son talking about how people are not necessarily treated as fair as they deserve to be. You'll hear the first mother talking to a child, a son who's probably about 11 years old is my guess. You'll hear a variety of these voices, and then I want to come back and talk about it.
Listen, it's an ugly, nasty word, and you are going to hear it. Nothing I can do about that. But you are not going to let that word hurt you. You hear me?
There are some people who think you don't deserve the same privileges just because of what you look like. It's not fair.
is not.
How's your review?
We're good.
You good?
Yeah,
you see?
We're good.
Okay.
Good.
Now, when you get pulled over.
I'm a good driver.
Okay. Baby,
don't worry.
This is not about you getting a ticket. This is about you not coming home.
I'm gonna be okay. Right? Okay.
Okay, baby.
It's not fair. But you keep showing up.
You are not pretty for a black girl. You are beautiful, period. Okay? Don't ever forget that.
Procter & Gamble's new commercial. I found it to be extraordinarily moving, and I want to get reaction from all of you on this. There have been some very... P&G's been getting some very nasty tweets. One of the most irresponsible videos I've ever seen. You condemn every white person as a racist, says one. Time to boycott Procter & Gamble, the company that manufactures, and it goes on to mention the products. Procter & Gamble, you foment fear of the police. You're dividing, just as our previous POTUS did. This is irresponsible and offensive. You know, Theron, here I am, an old white guy being moved by this commercial. What? Given that you have lived this life, tell me what you thought when you saw it the first time.
Well, let's clearly define the life. I mean, my mother had all those conversations with me when I was at the age to even comprehend what she was saying. Now, at the age of 39, guess what? My mother still has those conversations with me. So I had two reactions to the commercial. Let me, because I'm sometimes a little long-winded. One, let's commend Procter & Gamble for doing it, right? Okay, social awareness, being socially responsible is in right now at a time when we have this very divisive president in a country that's divided. But where I take issue is not so much of what Procter & Gamble did in the video, but it's the white people's response to it, which you were just talking about.
Yeah.
And so when I read the tweets and I did my research, I read a lot of blog posts, and you know, Brian knows this firsthand. I mean, Brian and I have been basically commentating across this city, the birthplace of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I had the privilege of talking to John Lewis yesterday, who 52 years ago the Voting Rights Act was signed. And Brian has witnessed firsthand people call me the N-word. He's witnessed this.
He's nodding.
And so what Brian and I have to do is, it's not so much of me fighting back on the person who actually used the N-word towards me. The reason Brian and I got close is because he stood up to this person. He stood up to this person making this comment in a very public way when we were with our good friend Laura Geary. Now, to me, yes. At a time where we have African-American men and women who are complying with law enforcement, who are doing everything they're supposed to do, and they're still not coming home to their loved ones, they're being shot and killed. White people, how dare you basically say that it's racist and that what we're going through, when you clearly see that every time you turn to your television set now, almost every week, is some person of color, particularly African-American male, who's being shot and killed, or who... And the white officer is being, you know, is being basically acquitted and getting off of these charges.
Well, if I could jump in here, I mean, I think it's pretty darn obvious that the Procter & Gamble spot wasn't aimed at black people. They know the conversations that are going on right now. What's happened is that we've become so polarized that we don't know what's going on in each other's households. And I think this was an attempt to show white people, white viewers, that these are very real conversations. They go on every day, and they're conversations that you never have to have with your kids. There should be something wrong with that.
But the one thing that I got, because there's a group of us, all of us are in politics. The guys, there's about 15 guys, and we're all involved in politics all across the world. And we had two responses to the video. And I read a lot during this tweet. One response was, okay, Procter & Gamble, you are a for-profit company. You know, you are out to make money. So why are you now entering a conversation about race and the things that black families, you know, conversations and black families. But then the other conversation we had on the Twitter, on the text thread, was you know what? Who next will step up and follow Procter & Gamble and have the guts enough to show the conversations that are happening in white households? And I think therein lies what you're saying, Jim. Yes, it was not aimed to motivate black people because, listen, we've been having those conversations for 100+ years. Now the question becomes, how are white people reacting? Because the ad was aimed at them. And what we're seeing is what Bill just said.
Yeah.
It's right down the middle.
You're seeing that in some part. Yeah. Look, trolls are trolls.
Right.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
And but you are going to have people who are moved by that.
Brian, what, Theron opened up the door for a very personal conversation. I don't want to ask you what the specific circumstances were of this moment.
Unless he wants to talk about
Of course. That's my point. I'm not going to can't force it. But what motivated you to decide to speak out? Because that's what takes the true courage, is when you don't let something slip, when you don't let it's easy to turn away. When you confront someone, however politely you may do it, that's a moment of courage.
I have not had an act of courage by any means. What Theron is referring to is we have did some longer commentary pieces with former Channel 2 reporter Lori Geary, and there were Facebook commentaries under. And, throughout all of last year, Theron and I did these all the time. And I was never personally attacked for what I was saying, even though many people would have found someone would have found what I said distasteful or wrong or want to attack me. It was never attacked for being white. And it was, all too often that someone would use the N-word when attacking what Theron had to say. And to get online and say, listen, buddy, I have no respect for somebody who uses that word. I have no respect for someone who would call my friend that. And Theron and I disagree on a lot of things, but no one has the right to call him that. I'm not going to stand for it.
Yeah. Olivia, can we post the link to this commercial on the blog today? I think if you haven't seen it, you really should. I'd love to encourage people to watch it. And you just come to gpbnews.org and click on programs, find Political Rewind, and you'll see the blog that accompanies today's show.
But one thing I want to commend you, Bill, for in GPB, the fact that we're in this room, I mean, we're all different. We're differently, the one similar thing that we all have is that we're all males, but we all come from different backgrounds. We all come from different race. And the fact that we can come in this room and have a civil discussion based on facts and express our opinion, therein lies what Procter & Gamble was trying to, I think, start. They're trying to have a national conversation.
That's their whole point, conversation.
And the question now becomes, which leader, which political figure or other organization is going to display what happens in white living room? And that's what I'm really interested to see, especially now in this Trump era.
Well, look, first of all, thank you for leading me into the reason I wanted to play this. I do think conversations like this matter beyond politics. We talk so much about partisan politics here, and I kind of commend Procter & Gamble for opening the door for the conversation.
Yes, can I just
Theron,
you asked, why would a business be doing this, be putting out that message? And this, to me, it's very practical. Polarization is bad for business.
Exactly.
All right. I'm sorry, I got to get to a break.
Absolutely.
As we go to the break, Terry Anowitz says in Twitter, I'm a jaded, cynical Gen Xer. I'm incredibly moved by that P&G daughter. Catherine Cummings says, I commend Procter & Gamble for investing in hard and truthful messages. Michael Jablonski, we all know Michael, referring back to the first conversation, I prefer a Trump vacation to a Trump working vacation. All right,
Jablonski,
thank you very much,
good man.
Mr. Jablonski. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back on Political Rewind.
Our brains are wired to avoid the things we fear and to crave pleasure. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Wright about the connection between Buddhist mindfulness meditation and what evolutionary psychology tells us about how the mind works. His new book is Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Wright also wrote the bestseller, The Moral Animal. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Brian Robinson, and Theron Johnson are in the studio today. We're glad to have all of them here. By the way, I want to make a quick note, because if I don't do it now, the show will run out of time. Everybody's on vacation on this team. Olivia Reingold is in there directing the show. She's with me. And we especially want to thank Tom Barkley at the mighty Wurlitzer Control Board, running the board for us.
Well
today.
Dressed, too.
It's a time.
He's an executive.
I mean, he's well dressed.
He's our operations manager. He's got to dress up. All right, Jim, I want to turn to something really very kind of light as we close out the show today. It's about our old friend Ben Jones, also known to the world as Cooter from Dukes of Hazzard. Ben Jones made his became a star doing that television program. He lived in Georgia, and back in mid-90s, he decided to get into politics, and he ran for Congress, lost the first time, ran in the 4th district, right. I think, lost the first time to Pat Swindle, who was a very polarizing Republican at the time. Mm-hmm. But the second time he faced Swindle, he won. I remember that Bobby Kahn and Roy Barnes both sort of encouraged him to get involved in that campaign. And he served 2 terms in Congress. Yeah,
he was a kind of a centrist Democrat, maybe even in his earlier days, more of a liberal. Did he lose to Cynthia McKinney?
The second time around he lost to John Linder.
Ah, that's right. Okay.
Who had been who had been an incumbent congressman. Mm-hmm. And then when he beat John Linder. I'm mm-hmm. sorry. He beat John Linder in the second race. Brian, he did. I think he beat Linder the second time, didn't he?
I do know that he succeeded.
We'll look it up.
Swindle, by the way, his daughter was in my class at UGA that I taught last fall. Small world, no?
Okay,
but anyway, he is now living. Cooter is now living in Virginia, in I think the western part of the state.
Yeah, yeah, and he's now profiting. We don't know how handsomely, but Politico had a big article about him that. He's out there in the persona of Cooter talking about we have to respect our heritage and our past and apparently keeping alive.
He has become a rallying point for neoconservatives.
Neo-Confederates.
Neo-Confederates, you're right. I'm sorry. Interesting. He says it's harmless.
We have a little soundbite. Let's listen to just a little bit of what he says about that.
Symbols mean different things to different people. And to us, it means something very positive. It stands for independence. It stands for the spirit of the South. And so we've got no problem with it. But history is complex. And we have different views of history. Everybody does. And my view of it is quite different from these politically correct people who are into cultural cleansing.
Cultural cleansing. All right, it's not a major story, but it is interesting.
You know, you had somebody on this radio station this morning, Richard Horde. He is the son of Floyd Horde.
Yep.
A Jackson County prosecutor.
Yeah, he was out on Second Thought.
That's right. He was on Second Thought. His dad was blown up by bootleggers back in 1967, and he was talking about the Dukes of Hazzard, as a matter of fact. And he says that, you know, in this Dukes of Hazzard, he said, was kind of like the Hogan's Heroes, the way Hogan's Heroes portrayed World War II. That's how Dukes of Hazzard portrayed rural life of that period. It was actually, for people like him, it was deadly. Moonshining was deadly. It was violent, and it was a really very brutal era.
You know, I grew up watching The Dukes of Hazzard, and I was a huge fan. It was like
You like Daisy.
Yeah, yeah. Even I was 5.
Be careful!
To,
be careful! Your wife is listening.
5 to 10 years. I was 5 to 10 years old. I think it's all safe for me to talk about. I loved the show. I had no idea at the time what the symbolism of it was, what this imagery was. You know, I agree with Zell Miller. when what he said when he was governor, that it's, as a Southerner, it's silly to suggest that all of my heritage is encapsulated in a four-year period. Now, I totally agree with that. I think what you're seeing here is a reaction to people that are seen as elites, or people who aren't from around here, as you may say, telling us we're bad people, telling us that we're stupid, telling us that we're racist. I think a lot of the Trump people and his voters are just people who are tired of being called backwards and racist. They're just tired of it. And I bet a lot of those people quoted in that story who said, this isn't about race for me, this is about identity. I think there's probably a lot of truth in what they're saying there, that they're not trying to oppress anybody. They're just saying, this is who we are, leave us alone, and we're gonna do something that you see as offensive just to make a point.
Well, and yet, when you look at photographs from the rallies that Ben has been involved with and see the Confederate flag flying, clearly that is offensive. There are people for whom that is a real, real trigger. Yeah, Theron? He doesn't even want to talk about
no.
it.
Look, I think the thing is this. You know, the most toured place, the number one attraction in Georgia is Stone Mountain. And I grew up as a kid in Athens, Georgia, about 40 minutes away from Stone Mountain, seeing people, while they're saying that they're celebrating their heritage, but displaying a flag that was misused by the KKK. I just think that when I hear white people being tired of being labeled as racist, it's not that all people of color are labeling white people as racist. It's just majority of the acts that are being done against people of color are committed by white people.
All right. Unfortunately, that's not a moment I would like to have to leave with, but I have to because we are out of time. I do need enough time to say I was right. I just looked at the Secretary of State's website. Ben Jones beat John Linder in 1990 by a substantial margin, 52% to 47%. So Jones served two terms. He lost in the subsequent election, came back and ran against the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, two election cycles later. So we put Ben Jones in the rearview mirror, as we did a long time ago. Brian Robinson, Theron Johnson, Jim Galloway, thanks so much for being here today. We're completely out of time again. Olivia Rheingold, Tom Barclay, thank you so much for what you're doing over there in the control room, keeping us on the air. Jim, we got a busy week here at Political Rewind, so we'll look forward to seeing you again later in the week.
I hope Wednesday.
I hope you're here on Wednesday, too. Take care, everybody. We'll be back Wednesday at 2.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to cut it off.